Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Fiona Cork. She's an Australian actor, wildlife campaigner, and activist. For about 15 years now, she's volunteered to protect wildlife, and for about 10 years as vice president for the Australian Society for Kangaroos, raising awareness of the beauty and also the cruel fate of kangaroo slaughter for damage mitigation by farmers and government departments and the commercial kangaroo industry for their meat and skins. In 2007, she co-founded the Macedon Ranges Wildlife Network, where she lives. The network is actively involved in wildlife rescue, wildlife care and rehabilitation, and raises awareness of the risks and threats wildlife faces from human interaction and imminent development. Today, we talk about corellas. So first, thank you, as always, for your great work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you, Derek, and thanks for asking me back on to talk about corellas. Thank you.
So people who don't live in Australia probably don't know what they are. Can you talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess a lot of people in the world, and probably in America, know about cockatoos, which are a white parrot or large parrot with a yellow crest on its head. A lot of them people do keep as pets. There's probably a number of people in America keeping them as pets as they do here in Australia. So corellas are a member of the cockatoo family, of which there are 21 species of cockatoos that come under that. So as I said, you've got your white sulfur-crested cockatoo, which is the one that usually people keep as pets. You've got your Major Mitchell cockatoo, which is a white cockatoo with some pink markings on it. You have the little corella, which we're going to talk more about today, and the long-billed corella. You have a number of other crested cockatoos. Then belong to the cockatoo family, you have dark cockatoos. And in those you get red-tailed black cockatoos, yellow-tailed black cockatoos, the Carnaby cockatoo over in West Australia, and several other ones as well. So cockatoos can come in, you know, white and dark colours. And then within under that too, you have gangang cockatoos, which are grey with red head, and palm cockatoos. So they're quite a big family of cockatoos. So the corella, which we're going to talk about today, there's two species of corella, and that's a little corella and a long-billed corella. The little corella has quite a large range over Australia, so they live in a lot of parts of Australia. The long-billed corella, however, has quite a limited range, and there are long-billed corellas in Western Australia, and there are long-billed corellas in Victoria, which is the southern state where I'm situated. But they're not all over Victoria. They're only in a few parts of Victoria. The long-billed corellas in Western Australia have, in the late 1990s, were considered not the same species of long-billed corellas as in Victoria, so they've been marked as separate species. So basically we're talking about the long-billed corella in Victoria being the only kind of its species, only living in Victoria and only living in a few areas of Victoria. So that's it with kind of, I think, describing cockatoos. I just want to be clear with your listeners, Derek, that I am no expert on cockatoos. I'm no expert actually on any wildlife. I do not have any formal training. I don't have any piece of paper after my name. I only know what I know because I just can't stand them being killed all the time, and I've had to learn. I've had to do my own study to find out more about this so I can actually do what I can to stop them being killed in the large numbers that they are. And they're killed in large numbers mostly for damage mitigation, because cockatoos always are in quite large flocks, particularly little corellas. So people want them killed because they say they damage their grain crops. People want them killed because they say they damage the sprinkler that's trying to put water on their crops or their grapes. People kill them because they sit on your roof and maybe pick at your antenna They want them killed because they'll sit in a tree and chew branches and twigs off and throw them on the ground, so that's considered messy. People want them killed because they say they're too noisy. And it kind of goes on and on. And that's really where I come in with all of this, is that I've been involved in a number of situations where there's been a damage mitigation permit out for a number of cockatoos or corellas, long-billed corellas and little corellas. And as I said, that's where I come in, to see what I can do with a few other people to try and stop them being killed and try and put some non-lethal methods of management on the table instead of this continual killing. There are a lot of fantastic non-lethal methods that have been tried and proven with little corellas and with long-billed corellas, but for some reason, as you would know, that happens in America with prairie dogs and all sorts of things, even if there's a solution on the table, they don't want to look at it because it seems to be, you know, the habit is to pick up a gun and shoot it, or with little corellas and long-billed corellas, their death is also of being trapped in large nets and then placed in 44-gallon drums of carbon monoxide to kill them. It is just the most cruel and unimaginable thing that we do, and that we keep committing these awful crimes on our wildlife.
So what are the, how big would a flock of corellas be, and what is the population of, especially the long-billed corella in Victoria?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. Nobody knows, of course, Derek. You know, they say that these species are secure and they're safe or they're abundant, but, you know, I was just looking yesterday because I thought you might ask me about how many long-billed corellas are in Australia. Well, according to Zoos Victoria, there are 180,000 long-billed corellas in Victoria. But if I was to read, so that's long-billed corellas, say there's a known amount of 180,000 little corellas, nobody would know. Personally, for myself, I believe the flocks of little corellas have reduced over the years. I remember flocks of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of corellas flying over, but the sky would be nearly white with them, and the sound would be deafening, but it was just amazing, and you'd sort of almost feel yourself right in there, because they sometimes fly low and you can feel yourself really as a part of the flock. It's amazing. The long-billed corellas are probably not in such big flocks as that. The long-billed corellas, and sometimes the little corellas, also hang out with other cockatoos. So you might go outside and you might see a group of sulfur-crested cockatoos feeding on the ground, but then you'll see maybe five or six long-billed corellas eating there with them. We also might see some galahs. I forgot to mention them as part of the cockatoo family before. They're grey with pink markings. So they all kind of fly together and feed together. So going back to the 180,000 long-billed corellas that they say are in Victoria, and they say that they're classed as being of a species of least concern. If I was to go back and just give you some estimates of some permits that were issued for those long-billed corellas, it wouldn't be hard to see that the species would be wiped out very soon. So, say for instance, last year in 2017, there were 50 permits issued for long-billed corellas, so this is for their death, and that meant the number of animals to be killed, or birds to be killed under those permits, was 5,854. So that's 5,854 birds had permits on them for, and if we go to the year before that, it's 3,830. If we go the year before that, it's 4,540. And the year before that is 6,744. So on it goes, Derek. We're talking about the numbers targeted to kill in their thousands. yet they say there's only 180,000 of them. But something else that's interesting about all this and what I read is that they say that the long-billed corella isn't in trouble, really, because it seems to have expanded its range. And when they say it's expanded its range, they're saying that with the assumption that the expansion of the range means that there are actually more long-billed corellas. But that's not necessarily the case. One of the really big issues that are facing all the cockatoos, including the long-billed and little corellas, is the lack of available nesting sites and lack of suitable nesting sites. With all the land clearing and logging, all the old trees are being removed. I mean, it takes over 150, 160 years for a hollow to actually start to be formed in a tree. So, this is a really, really big concern that there aren't enough nesting sites left for these birds. So they're expanding their range, I would think, is that they've expanded their range to try and find suitable nesting sites, also perhaps for food. It doesn't necessarily mean that there are more of them, but that's what's assumed within that. And I think that's the thing with all wildlife. It happens with kangaroos. You know, they say, oh, kangaroos expanded their range. They were never here before, but they're here now. But they don't consider that where they were before now has a whole lot of, you know, a residential housing estate on it or, you know, a supermarket or whatever. So they don't realise that wildlife gets pushed to places where it might not normally live, and then they complain to go, oh my God, now there's a plague of them. So, and that's what happens with the corellas. You know, it comes back to there being a plague of them. But corellas naturally will always fly in a very large flock. It's obviously for their protection. They don't have a lot of predators besides humans, which would be their biggest predator. I think you'd be looking at wedge-tailed eagles, peregrine falcons have been known to take cockatoos and corellas. They don't have a lot of predation or predators, but they are unfortunately prone to a disease called beak and feather disease, and they can contract this when they're quite young. I actually have a couple of cockatoos that come here every year. We've got chooks, so they're always hanging around to try and get the last of the chook food. And so I have a pair of sulfur-crested cockatoos that come here every year, amongst other ones, but I know this couple. And unfortunately, every year they have a beak and feather baby. And it's really sad because there's not much you can do for beak and feather, even if I was to catch that young cockatoo and try and treat it. It's not known whether that beak and feather disease can ever be gone from the system. So the parents obviously are carriers of it, but they don't exhibit the signs of beak and feathers. It's known that it might come through their saliva, so that would come through the nesting and also the feeding. It's incredibly sad, and it's a horrible disease because their beaks grow very long and misshapen, their feathers don't grow properly, and then their feathers start to fall out. And then winter comes and it gets very cold and they don't usually make it past winter. And they also have trouble with their weight and putting weight on. I did save one year on our back veranda. He was just hanging out there. His parents actually weren't with him anymore. And so I went out and I could just pick him up. He was just sitting there and I picked him up. And when I did, I got a bit of a fright because he was very light in weight. So I took him to a friend of mine who runs a wildlife shelter, and we tried to do what we could for him. But unfortunately, he passed away because he also had some parasites. Well, so basically the beak and feather disease can weaken their whole immune system that then makes them much more open to parasites. That's the thing with them.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to talk sometime too about how corellas and particularly little corellas, long-billed corellas can be true, but little corellas are highly social and they're extremely playful. So you'll see them outside and they'll be playing and they'll be hanging off a tree or off a, you know, electricity wire, or and they'll kind of spin around and around and they'll play with each other on the ground and jump on one another. It's lovely to watch them interact, and they're very well known for their playfulness. They'll slide down roofs and all sorts of things. If you look on YouTube, there's a lot of clips on there about little corellas and corellas having fun. But to go back, I guess, more to their nesting and how they grow up. So you have a pair of corellas, any of the cockatoo family, which includes corellas. They mate for life. They don't become sexually mature till they're between 3 and 7 years old, so it's quite late, because they live to be over 50 in the wild. Cockatoos in captivity have been known to live to 90 or 100 years old, but they say that they, in the wild, they don't live that long. So we're looking at probably around 50 to 60 years that they live in the wild, so obviously their sexual maturity is later. There's a lot they have to learn when they're younger from their parents about, you know, good feeding grounds, where water is. They usually roost near water courses, and, you know, predation. So there's a lot of things that they need to learn when they're younger. And so when they do find their mate is for life, and they find, hopefully, a suitable nesting hollow, and 2 to 4 eggs would be laid in that hollow. I've never personally, but as in, again, I'm not an expert or I don't know, I've only ever seen probably at the most 2 young within Corella. I've never seen 3 or 4. So they will be chicks and they get fed by both parents. And they'll be in their nesting hollow for about 12 weeks, so it's about 3 months, and then they venture out. I think what's really interesting with them too is that when they get to that size, it's actually, like if you were to see them in a tree, it would be very, you wouldn't be able to tell which were the adults and which was the young one, because they seem to get as big as the adult quite quickly, although their behaviour is the only thing that shows them as being a baby, because they will just sit in the tree and whine and make noises all day and demand to be fed. And that can, I've got some that sit in a tree out the back here and do that. But all this time they still need to be, even though they're as big as their parents, they still need to be fed by their parents. No way are they independent. So they'll be crop-fed by their parents, and they're taught the lie of the land, where everything is. I'll just think where I was up to with that. So that's basically about it with their breeding. That's what I wanted to say, that's right. What's been noticed amongst the cockatoo family, it's really very, very moving. I haven't noticed it much so personally with corellas, although I would think that they would do the same, but I have noticed it with galahs. I've had several experiences of that, including my mother has had one. I actually tell you my mother's experience because it was really interesting. She was driving down the road and it was just a dirt road, and up ahead she saw a group of galahs who are members of the cockatoo family. They're pink and grey. She saw about 10 of them on the road in front of her in a kind of circle, and she stopped the car and she thought, that's really unusual. So she stopped the car and, you know, she didn't want to scare them off the road. They obviously seemed to be doing something. And she sort of got out of the car and stood up and looked. And what was going on was that there was a dead galah, one of their own, had died on the road, and the others had come to gather around. And they gather around in a circle and they sort of talk and bow their heads up and down and do that for a while, and they will stay near the dead body also for quite a while. And I have noticed this often with cockatoos and galahs, and I will always stop and get one off the road. If its mate has died, that one will be, it'll just stand next to it and bob its head up and down and just stay with it. So you have to remove the dead one off the road. And I might just try and put it off the road so that its mate can continue its grieving for it. It's really moving, and it's, very sad, but that's also a part of corellas and galahs and cockatrices, the whole family. That's a part of their social structure and their behaviour.
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, add to that, that's why when they get culled or killed, whether they're shot or whether they're trapped and netted and gassed in 44-gallon drums of carbon monoxide, what it does is that it leaves a lot of young orphaned, because they always dishing out the permits over the summer, and that's when they're young and they need, they're totally dependent on their parents, and they can't be identified as being a younger bird. That's why I wanted to mention that before. So, for instance, a shooter couldn't stand there and go, oh, that's a young one and they're the adults. They all look to be the same size, and a shooter's probably not going to take the time to look at their behaviour. Just take the gun out and shoot as many as they can in a short space of time before anyone finds out what they're doing and can stop them. So it's very, very sad in these situations, and that a lot of, well, we actually don't, nobody knows the amount of young that are left orphaned because their parents have been shot or killed in some way. And it's incredibly irresponsible, because then you're also adding more dead animals that they're not counting as being dead. They might kill the parents who are both dead, and then down the track that young one will die. But that's never counted as being one of the ones of the figures that I read out before. There's all sorts of consequences that you would be aware of down the track. And so it's just very cruel to leave a young bird to starve, to slowly die, because it can't eat food because it's still being crop-fed, which means that the parent bird mushes up the food and brings the food up, and actually with its beak pushes food down that younger bird into its crop through its mouth. So, it poses a lot of problems. And as I said, there's no need to actually shoot or kill to kill any wildlife. There's a lot of non-lethal methods on the table, and nobody really can be bothered looking at them, and that's what I want to try and push. That, as I said, is just a habit of picking up a gun, and that's the way it's done, particularly in country areas in Australia, as would probably be the same in America or any other country. Yet in the city, for instance, in the city of Melbourne, if there's an issue there on the cricket club with cockatoos or whatever, they won't bring a shooter in to kill them, because it's in the city and everyone would find out and everybody would be so horrified and it would all be open. So then they get a non-lethal method and it works. But then, for instance, there might be a golf club 100 kilometres from the city that wants to shoot kangaroos, shoot corellas, but they're not made to get a non-lethal method because it's in the country and no one will ever know, it's just a little golf club, so we're not going to be bothered. And this kind of hypocrisy really, really annoys me. You know, if the government department, environmental department, is going to say that that's okay to use it in the city, and hey, it works, everybody, isn't that great, we don't have to shoot them, why can't they do that everywhere else? They can't be bothered. And then it's left up to volunteers like myself and others to try and address and fix these problems. It's incredibly unfair and really, it's just ridiculous.
Well, I'm thinking a few things. One of them is, a long time ago, you were talking about expanding range, and that reminded me of something that I read about when I was writing Strangely Like War, which is that there are what some people call extinction debts, because there has been habitat loss, but the creatures weren't killed themselves. And so forest-dependent exactly. creatures, for example, and then if there can be, I don't know, you know, 10 of this species per square mile, and there's 10 of them living in 100 square miles, well, 10 of them per square mile, 100 of them living in 10 square miles, and then you destroy half of that forest, you still have those extras. Just yesterday, I was in town and wearing a sweater that had a mountain lion on it, and a guy said, "Hey, I saw one of those just yesterday walking across the road." And, you know, mountain lions don't want to live in town. And it's, you see this a lot, that there are, or back in the 80s and 90s when there was a big flap over spotted owls, that they were saying that spotted owls were causing logging to go down. Some of the anti-environmentalists would say, "Hey, I've seen a spotted owl sitting in town." And it's like, yeah, the reason you saw the spotted owl sitting in town is because you cut all the trees within, you know, 20 miles. And so there's that. And then another thing I was thinking was, different subject. I was just watching a baseball game a couple days ago on TV with the San Francisco Giants, and a guy missed a fly ball because seagulls got in his way. And evidently seagulls are an absolutely standard part of the game at Giants games. Mm-hmm. And the announcers are making jokes about how the seagulls start assembling in the seventh or eighth inning of a nine-inning game, because they know that after nine innings, everybody's going to leave and there's going to be all sorts of nachos and everything else that everybody left behind. And the point is that in San Francisco, at least, I mean, I don't know what they do elsewhere in the city, but the Giants games, basically everybody just laughs about it. And it's not. And then the third thing I was going to say was what you said about how the country is different than the city. Is I've lived in the country much of my life, and a phrase that was very common in some of the cities, or I'm sorry, some of the places I've lived, is it's the three S's: shoot, shovel, and shut up. And
exactly. I've never heard that one.
That's pretty much the attitude in the countryside here to any species that harms, or that you perceive as possibly may someday in some way harm any economically valuable crop. Or actually anybody who's wild, just leave it at that.
Or even just be too noisy, or just that there's too many of you, you know, it seems to be some sort of threat, whether they actually destroy anything or not. If you're talking about kangaroos, the same thing. The farmer will look out and go, "Oh, I think there's too many kangaroos." Doesn't mean they've done anything. It's just his opinion. So he can apply for a permit for one. I mean, it's just insane. It's interesting what you said earlier.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that, but yeah, about the expansion, and I think you were referring to kind of or pointing to kind of regional extinctions, or where things can disappear and come up in other places. And I mean, if you look at the story of the passenger pigeon, which I know you know very well, Derek, is that no, not every one of the passenger pigeons was shot. You know, not all of them were killed. As I understand it, I actually spoke to a climate change scientist once about extinction and how it happens. And it's actually something that nobody really knows exactly how extinction happens. But he cited the story of the passenger pigeon, which I also knew as well. I've known it since I was a kid, my father. But he said with the passenger pigeons, he said, no, they weren't all shot. He said, but what happened was that the flock was reduced. The flocks were reduced to such a small size that because they relied on large numbers that they actually couldn't survive. One, because the reduction in their numbers led them to be very stressed. The reduction in their numbers led to not enough genetic diversity for their breeding. So it was a number of these things that actually caused them to become extinct, because they couldn't survive in smaller numbers. this is what I don't think people understand. So it's all very well to say we had, say, 180,000 long-billed corellas in Victoria and they're classed as secure. And I read out how many thousands, you know, have permits issued for them every year, yet they still say they're secure. But how do we know what number of long-billed corellas is going to reach? Is it, if it gets down to 100,000, is that going to be the tipping point for them that they won't be able to survive? Animals need their, you know, they need that larger number in the flock to actually survive. And if it's reduced, they'll just go. And it could be the same with kangaroos as well, particularly the red kangaroo. So these are all the things that it's not properly understood. I can't believe that we're where we are now and this actually isn't really understood, or maybe it is, but they're not telling anybody. It's really a disaster because it can happen so quickly without anybody knowing. That is the thing. The numbers can be reduced like that because there's no record taking. I mean, our state environmental department dishes out permits, but they don't ask for any returns. So they say, well, we've issued this many permits, but we have no idea how many animals were killed in those, animals and birds were killed in the permits that we issued last year. So there's not even any record keeping, there's not even any proper way of being able to monitor our wildlife. And most wildlife in Australia is protected. Unfortunately, the cockatoo family isn't protected and wombats aren't protected, but most other wildlife is. But it still doesn't make any difference if it's protected under legislation to have this kind of monitoring put on it. Oh, sure, they do surveys for kangaroos. That's one, but they only do the surveys because they want to have a commercial meat industry and they have to for their export license. It's not because they want to, it's because they have to, or because they care. So I think what's really interesting, and maybe you're referring to, is that yes, we think, people assume that animals and birds have spread because we see them in places that we haven't before, but it doesn't mean that at all. It actually really is a sign that they're in big trouble. That's how I see it. Because if they have only ever been in a preferred range, like the long-billed corella, you know, they would have been in those other places before if they liked it. But obviously it's not their preferred place. They would like to be where they always were. So as I said, I just think it's a sign they're in trouble, and it's not seen like that by the authorities who manage our wildlife.
So before we talk about the non-lethal means of deterrence that you want to promote, can you talk a little bit about what is their native habitat, preferred habitat, and also what do they eat in the wild?
Okay. Well, they all need trees to roost and to nest in, so that's obviously very important, and also with water. So corellas are probably more known for it, but I'm not too sure on this, as I said, I'm not an expert, but generally a lot of cockatoos will roost along watercourses or where there is a water source. They will eat, they feed off the ground, so they will eat some bulbs, like onion grass bulbs and some other different corms. They'll also eat some grubs from the ground. They've also been known, some species, to eat termites and beetles that live under bark. So they're fairly, I guess, diverse in their feed. And that's what then, if you're coming back to golf courses, this where it brings a problem, or bowling clubs or tennis clubs, cricket grounds, because corellas come and cockatoos come and feed off the ground and they can tend to dig it up. So they will use their beak to push through the ground and get grubs and corms and bulbs, and of course the golf clubs and tennis and bowling clubs don't like that because it leaves a mess and it makes the ground uneven, and that's why they want to kill them. So that's a problem in that regard. So that, and I guess too, those places are I've watered a lot, you don't have sprinkles on them, so there perhaps may be more food on those places than other places, so they may be attracted to them. So yeah, that's basically what they eat. But they seek their food under the ground, which causes the problem, yeah.
Why do people who run vineyards care then? Do they eat the grapes? Because you'd think that if they're just disturbing the ground there, they're just sort of doing a mini tilling. That doesn't seem like a problem.
Well, yes, I see it's probably their way. It's like they're aerating the soil. I mean, all these things are important. It's not that they do it for just because they can. Everything that I believe, and as you probably do too, Jan, everything that they do in nature is for a reason. It's all symbiotic. It's all, if they do that, it aerates the soil and this happens and then that
absolutely
happens.
Absolutely.
But humans don't see it like that. Humans don't see it like that. It's like that, you know, Corella's made a mess on my lawn, or it's made a mess on the golf club. And then they say, oh, we can't have our great golf tournaments now because our golf clubs are not top condition. Our fairways have got holes in them. That's what it's about. And this is about recreation. So there are, as I said, there are a number of non-lethal deterrents, but we can get to that when...
No, let's go ahead with that. What are some of the non-lethal deterrents?
Okay, so there's quite a number of them. You know, for instance, there's kites that look like eagles and they flap around, they have them in the sky. I mean, they use those on the Melbourne cricket ground in the city to keep seagulls and cockatoos and all sorts of things off that ground, and it's highly successful. They used once a wedge-tailed eagle, a trained eagle that would come back to its owner, so the eagle is trained to scare the cockatoos away as a predator. And they use that on the Art Centre Tower, for instance, in the city, because these are not talking about corellas, but cockatoos were picking at the spire, and they were worried that they were going to pull it apart. Of course, they couldn't go and shoot them, because everyone in the city would hear and know about it, so they did the right thing there and tried a non-lethal method using a live wedge-tailed eagle. It didn't kill any of them, it was just to scare them, and that worked. A number of other places use light beam devices that distract the birds and disorientate them from their roosting sites. A number of golf courses have actually used these devices, and also people with crops, and they've been highly successful. Depending on the size of their property or their golf club or bowling green or whatever, they may need to use several of them. But they've had great success, and I've spoken to golf clubs who use them, and they just say that they're fantastic. Yet we have golf clubs here in Victoria who just won't look at it, who just refuse to, and say they don't work, yet they don't even try it. They would just rather shoot them. It's just a stubbornness. So there are, and for instance, one of the issues that I cited, for instance, someone gets a permit to kill corellas or cockatoos because they're damaging the sprinkler systems in their vineyard or somewhere. And I just say to them, why don't you make a wire cage that covers the sprinkler system? Like, it doesn't even make sense to what you're saying. You've got a long-term thing here. Either bury the sprinkler underground, cover it in some kind of metal cage so that it can't be tampered with, and then you've got the problem solved forever. I just don't think people can really think around things anymore, Derek. It just seems that people can't use their brain to work things out. And it's just, I'll get a permit and I'll shoot them. So you shoot those ones and then more come, and then they shoot those and more come. I call it the Elmer Fudd syndrome. You know, he's sitting up there on his fence and just keeps shooting and shooting and shooting without realizing that it's not changing anything. So you're depleting the species.
So how did you get started, and how did you get started? How did you go from, wow, this is a drag to actually doing something about it?
Yeah, I don't actually know what it is within me, Derek. I don't know if I could even describe it. It's just something within me that I can't. I just have to do something about it. I just can't stand seeing that kind of unfairness and injustice continue. You know, we need to stand up and try and do something about it. So I guess that's what I've done. I mean, a lot of the Corellas, the shooting of Corellas, Little Corellas and Long-billed Corellas, happens outside the area of, say, the Maston Ranges Wildlife Network. That network is really to an area of our shire. I don't really have a platform to be able to talk about Corellas on a larger level, and there isn't really a group out there who's talking about this sort of stuff, which is a shame. I've tried to encourage people that would be a great idea, but it hasn't really come off yet. So at the moment, really, we're dealing with issues here and there. They're just little bushfires, basically, that you've got to put out. It's not one big blanket approach. So every time, you know, there'll be another golf club that wants to shoot, so then we've all got to get onto that. Then we hear about another place that's happening, and that can be quite exhausting. But there's a few of us now, there's probably a couple of handfuls of us now across the state that are trying to do what we can, and we kind of work together to circumvent these culls of Corellas that are happening. And that seems to have worked quite well over the last couple of years, although some of them, these places have backtracked and still tried to get a permit to kill and have said that non-lethal methods don't work. And really the only way through this is to try and embarrass. That's all we've got, is to embarrass the golf club as much as you can publicly, or the council that wants to kill them because they're wrecking the local cricket pitch. And talk about it. Really that's the tool, is to talk about it, get stories in the local papers or any media that you can. That's a tool to be able to talk about what's going on, because really a lot of people don't know, because a lot of people don't think about it. Because wildlife, I think animals might be on their agenda, but wildlife is the last thing pretty much. I think a lot of people, they don't think about it at all.
You know, there's a line that really hit me hard from Naomi Klein's film based on her book, This Changes Everything. In there, she says, toward the end, something about how, you know, I've been to a bunch of climate marches, but I got to tell you, you know, polar bears, I wish them well, but they just don't do it for me. This is all about us. And that, that's the problem with modern environmentalism. And
absolutely, yeah. And threatened species. Everyone wants to say the threatened species, but as I say, every species was common before it became threatened. I actually concentrate on what they call abundant and common species, because they're actually the ones that are going to be threatened next. That's where I come from.
Obviously, if somebody wants to try to work on a threatened species, I got no problem with that. But
absolutely.
But I agree with the approach that the time to really try to save a species is when they're going from incredibly common to kind of common. I mean, because then you can make mistakes. You can, you know, you can try to. It takes time to start building up. So I completely agree with your approach.
Mm.
So,
so it's hard to know where. I think, you know, I just had to start doing something, because I just couldn't bear to see so many thousands of birds being shot or gassed every year, leaving their babies orphaned. I just can't stand it.
And if, let's say that someone hears this in Australia, and they want to do, they also have been bothered by this, but they've not been able to figure out what to do. What should they do?
Well, I think what they could do is find, if what I would probably suggest is find any other people around them who feel the same way as them, even if it's one other person. And with that, go to your local paper, talk about the issue, contact whoever it is that is doing the shooting or the culling, and either try to talk to them and offer them non-lethal methods, because they may not be aware that non-lethal methods exist, so at least tell the person who may be wanting to kill them that they exist and that they're available, and offer a solution to them. And yeah, that's what we do. And then, as I said, go to the paper, talk about that, and they will feel the pressure. They'll either feel the pressure or not. Some of them, it's harder for them to feel the pressure, and some of them feel the pressure very easily. It's about testing the water, I guess. There's no one recipe for that. I think you just have to try it and see how that club or that, the golf club, the bowling club, the tennis club, even the landowner, well, that might be a bit different because he'll claim his financial loss as being really a major thing. But I just think the thing is to say that there is a solution and that they don't need to kill. Do they know about it? And if they're not going to go ahead with that, then you just have to go to the paper and let everybody know that they're killers. And that's pretty much the method that we use here. And that's been quite successful when we haven't had much help or there's not a lot of us to do that.
And so what about on other issues, like if there is someone cares about wombats, or somebody in the United States cares about, spotted owls? I mean, how do you, if somebody cares about something apart from your two issues, your two primary issues of corrals and kangaroos, how do they get started? How do they get the guts to do something in the first place?
Yeah, not quite sure if I know the answer to that, where you get your guts from to do something like that. I guess when I started with Derek, I thought there would be more people who would want to do something. I guess after doing it for this long, I've realised that there's not many people who really want to do it. It's all really too hard. But I don't want to put anybody off by saying that. You know, there are a number of wildlife organisations in Australia, national organisations. There's a lot of little wildlife groups throughout the state. So I guess that's another thing that they could do, is to contact their local wildlife group or a national group and see what can be done. If they want support from a national or a bigger group, perhaps they could put that to the group. But they might still need to drive that with the group, you know, to say, look, I'd like to do something. Can I do something under your group? Or what is your group doing about this? Can I help do that? I guess that's something. So you either, I guess, you can work on your own with a couple of other people to see what you can do, or you could try to work through a bigger organisation. That would be probably at this stage what I would suggest.
So I guess the last question is kangaroos, corellas, and are there any others you're thinking of taking on?
No.
I know, it's just a horrible question.
I know, Jake. I wish I could. I wish there was three or four of me, because then I could probably get a lot more done. I really feel for wombats because they're not protected, but I know that there are people out there trying to do what they can for wombats, and I know that spoke to Bridget Stevens, I think, a year or so ago about what she's doing for wombats in South Australia. She and Claire are amazing with what they do. And there are a number of people that put a lot of work into wombats, so that makes me feel that something is being done. But it is a long haul, and really wildlife needs people. It really needs everybody's help. And if, I guess, more people help, then it wouldn't be such a load for volunteers who are trying to do it on their own or in small groups with no resources, no finance, no funds, no finances. That's not what drives us. I think what compels people to save wildlife is that they just love it and they don't want to see it disappear. And we want to try and encourage other people to do the same, because it is up to us. The government authorities have clearly, repeatedly shown that they're not interested in trying to protect it. They're only there to manage it. And manage it means to kill it. It doesn't even mean to manage it with non-lethal methods. I mean, our Environment Department says we only issue permits after all non-lethal methods have been exhausted. It's never the case. It's a lie, because that's what they say on their website, that's what they say on the application for a permit, yet they don't actually have to push that. The farmer or the permit applicant could turn around and go, oh, it wasn't practical for me to do that. And that's how they get out of it. So these are the issues we face, but the more people that can stand up against it, that's what will hopefully make life better for wildlife generally, not only in Australia, but all around the world, where it's left.
Well, you know, every time we talk, it reminds me of something that a friend of mine says often, which is that love is a verb.
Mm.
And, you know, yeah. I wish that more people understood that. And, and I would just really like to, thank you again for all your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. And my guest today has been Fiona Cork. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.